Thank y'all. As I said, there are handouts on the center table, which include a picture if you'd like one, as well as I decided actually to make the print larger this week because when I was typing, don't look at me that way. When I was typing, it was only going to go about three or four lines on the second sheet, and so I made it down to 9 font size, and then I thought, ooh, I don't need to make it 9 font size. So that's why it's so large this week. This week, want to look at, and it also takes a church. Ooh, just saw a typo. Oh well. Want to talk about the phrase which we find both in Matthew 2 and in Luke chapter 2, and Jesus grew. And of course they talk about, and Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and with humans. But Jesus grew in large part because of, and we're looking here, at family influence. And while we really have very little information about Jesus as a child in the biblical text, there are non-canonical writings that contain things, such as the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, which contains some rather fantastical stories. The biblical narratives give us very little about the childhood of Jesus. As I say here, Mark and John, the Gospels of Mark and John, don't even talk about Jesus as a child. They don't have birth narratives. Gospel of Mark picks up with the baptism being done by John the Baptist when he is almost 31 years old and Jesus is about 30 years old. John talks about the preexistence of Christ as the divine Logos, but then jumps right straight into Jesus' adulthood and adult ministry with John the Baptist. Matthew and Luke are the only two canonical Gospels with birth narratives. As I said, there are other non-canonical documents that have birth narratives, such as the Protoevangelium of James and the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, as well as stories about Jesus as a child. But biblically, canonically, all we have are what we find in Matthew and Luke, which is very little as a whole. But there are some things that we can infer, I think, from what we find here. Matthew speaks of the birth, the visit of the Magi, Herod's plot to kill the baby, and we'll talk about that next session, and a brief mention of, got to change that, the flight of the Holy Family to Egypt. That doesn't mean they sprouted wings. It doesn't mean they had to wait on El Al Airlines, but that they ran away for fear of what Herod's plot was. So Matthew gives us even less information than does Luke. Luke, on the other hand, includes stories of Jesus' birth, as Matthew does, but there are differences, as we've talked about before. In Matthew, you've got Magi and King Herod and the plot to kill Jesus and the flight to Egypt and all those kinds of things. And you've got a star, but you have no mention of shepherds. And the only time the angels are mentioned are in dreams. Angel appears to Joseph in a dream. Angel appears again in a dream to Joseph to tell him, y'all need to get out of Dodge because Herod's after your child. Luke, on the other hand, talks about John the Baptist and his birth. The angel Gabriel visits Mary. But Luke also includes stories about the naming of John, the shepherds. Luke never mentions a star, although we always have him looking up at the star. Mentions the shepherds and also the birth of Jesus in a manger. In Matthew, if all we had to go on was Matthew, where do the Magi find Mary and the baby, or the babe, the child, excuse me, Mary and the child? No, not in Matthew, that's in Luke. He's born placed in a manger, but by the time the wise guys get there, that's right, Jerry. Going into the house, they found Mary and the child. So they'd already moved on from the manger and the stable into a house. But Luke tells us about the stable and the shepherds. But Luke also contain some things in the birth stories of Jesus that everybody else leaves out. Luke talks about, and we talked about this in detail when we had our Luke study last year, but Luke talks about the circumcision of Jesus at 8 days. Luke talks about the purification sacrifices for Mary based on the law at the time where Simeon comes in and grabs up Jesus and holds him up and sings a song about this child, declaring him Messiah, and that a sword will pierce Mary's heart. And Anna, the prophetess, comes in and sees this child and begins going out spreading throughout all of Jerusalem that she has just found the Messiah, the consolation of Israel. Luke also includes the story of Jesus in the temple at age 12. And like Matthew, Luke says that Jesus, in fact, in two places, Luke says that Jesus grew and became strong and filled with wisdom. But I think we see more in Luke's account this sense of family influence and why Jesus grows in wisdom and in stature and in favor. In fact, Luke mentions that he grows in favor not only with God, but with other people as he grew. And so I think that we find he's filled with wisdom in large part through his family's influence. And so I want us to talk a little bit tonight about those influences and what we might find, and why I think that perhaps, especially Luke chapter 2, some in Matthew, but especially Luke chapter 2, Luke sheds a little bit of light on Jesus' childhood and challenges us on the ways we look at children and their childhoods and how perhaps how we care for children. I don't think I would be far wrong or far off by concluding that the folks who are gathered here tonight in this room who have raised children, whether biological, adopted, or others, maybe foster or others who came into your care, I don't think I would be far off, if off at all, to say I'm probably talking more to the choir than others, because most of you, if not all of you, who had some contact with children have at least made attempts at raising them with something of a biblical perspective, with a church perspective, in church, etc. And you cared for children that way. And many of you continue to care for children that way. But not everyone does, and perhaps even we who have done so can find ways that, or think about ways that we can help our children, our grandchildren, our friends' children, and the children who come here at other times, or children who are under our care in classrooms, although in public school we've got to be a little careful about that these days, in nurturing them and caring for them. So, in both Matthew 2 and Luke 2, we find Mary and Joseph nurture Jesus. And we find some evidence, even though Luke keeps Joseph in the background. Luke really does. We hear very little about Joseph, and quite frankly, at the end of Luke chapter 2, Joseph is never mentioned again in the gospel, by name in the Gospel of Luke. But Jesus is loved and cared for by Mary and Joseph, and he has been nurtured even to the point of obedience. In Luke chapter 2, verses 50 and 51, as Mary and Joseph have lost God's son and then frantically searched for him and found him, of course, dear old mom opens her mouth. She can get away with these kinds of things. And basically says, "Boy, why did you scare us like this? Child or son, why have you treated us like this? You took off, we didn't even know. Look, your father and I have been searching for you in great anxiety," verse 48. And of course, Jesus answers, it's not an answer of disrespect. In verse 49, "Why were you searching for me?" In other words, why did you go looking everywhere else? You should have come here first. That's what he was saying. did you not know that I must be in my Father's house? But they did not understand what he said to them, verse 50. Now, some scholars think that Mary and Joseph didn't completely understand why he responded this way and what he was saying. I think it's maybe a little there, but it's primarily the teachers, the scribes, and the elders who were there that didn't really understand why is he saying this is his Father's house. He doesn't live in here. But then Jesus, the text says, then he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was obedient to them. Because of the nurture and the love and the care by Mary and Joseph, Jesus is obedient. She doesn't, unless we're missing something, she doesn't grab him by the ear and drag him out. Joseph doesn't pull off his belt or his sash and say, come on, or else. Heard somebody today. It's funny. I came out of my office and somebody today with a young child said, you come now. Don't make me count to five. And I was standing next to someone else who is loosely kin to them, but I said, what happened to three? Five? And the person next to me chuckled and said, yeah. And the person responded, well, he knows that I better not get to five. But you know, it was always three with me and with our kids. You better not let me get to three. Although I have heard somebody say, you mind, don't you let me get to three. One, two. I'm telling you, don't you let me get to three. One, two. Don't you let me get to three. One, two, two and a half. All right. Yeah. And some got counts and some didn't get counts. And sometimes you were about counted out. I think Ed was about counted out, right? But here we say, immediately, without any question, Jesus is obedient to them. Well, that obedience, of course, obedience can be taken in different ways, but the inference here is they've done everything according to the law. They've continued to nurture him according to the law. They've obviously taught him about the law and about his religion. And as children are supposed to be obedient, Jesus obeys. Very possibly a sign of the nurture and the care that they have. We also find that they're very protective. And I mentioned here that next week we'll talk a little bit about the plot on Jesus' life. Not just looking at the crucified man, but the difficulties even as a child that faced he and his family, even when he really wasn't aware of it. But they're protective. They get word that Herod is going to be looking for them. And what do? They leave and they go to Egypt, even though Matthew says that's to fulfill the prophecy. Out of Egypt has I called my son. But they went to Egypt to protect him. And they stayed there until they got news that Herod had died. And then they came back. But they were protective of him there. They're also protective of him here in the Gospel of Luke, making sure that everything is done in order, but also being very protective, watching over him, caring for him, and taking him the places he needed to go. They're reflective. We're told in chapter 2, verse 19, and also in chapter 2, verse 51, and Mary kept or treasured these things in her heart. The first one was when the shepherds came. She was reflective, reflected on, well, what does this mean? I'm sure she reflected upon what Simeon had to say in the temple too, but wasn't completely sure. But she thought about these things. She reflected also upon the responsibility. And I think Joseph reflected upon the responsibility that he had. And we hear more and more about Mary, and I'm sure she reflected later in his life and probably said why at some points in time. But I
stressed out knowing that they've got some guy here that surely there's a fix, so to speak, and all they got to do is kind of go through the motions at a certain point.
Don't call me Shirley.
I would not worry about anything, you know, like, okay, we'll go down this trail, we'll flee, and all this kind of stuff and everything. They surely know
Well, I'm not so sure that they know he's not going to be killed, Shirley. No. I'm not so sure that, you know, I think there were probably a lot of stresses. I mean, and they lose him when he's 12 years old, and the text says they searched frantically. I imagine frantic is probably an understatement. And, you know, fleeing because, you know, Herod, and I'm sure they wondered, why in the world's king trying to kill our baby? You know, he's just a baby. Well, he grows up. Well, he can defend himself, but he's just a baby. Mary, there's at least one point in time where Mary and Jesus' younger brothers come looking for him, and they want him to come on outside. They want him to come outside to send word inside. They said, your mother and your brothers are looking for you. And one of the texts says, because they thought he's a little bit off. And that's when he says, who are my mother and brothers and sisters? You know, that kind of thing. But I think that there was probably extra stress, not wanting to make a mistake, but at the same time, I think that even with that in mind, that, okay, this is a miracle, we've had angelic voices, we've had angelic visions, we've been told this child is going to be the Savior of the world, well, how's that going to be? I'm sure that the threats, any parent would see those threats and really be stressed out. I'm pretty sure that they were probably stressed to the max on several occasions. And Mary ponders these things. Mary is reflective. I think Joseph probably is as well. And reflecting upon his responsibility. But I'm not so sure that even when Simeon said what he did about to Mary, and a sword will pierce your heart also, that she fully understood that. You know, and maybe, you know, she probably was thinking, you know, she had grown up as a child, and she probably wasn't, unless you're a particular Christian denomination and think she never sinned and never did anything wrong, she probably wasn't always, you know, she probably disappointed her parents some. And they had seen other children. And then after Jesus is born, Matthew says that Joseph knew her not, that is in the biblical sense, sexually knowing her, until after she had born Jesus. Well, you've got brothers and sisters here that grow up, and they've seen other people out there. So I'm sure that they were very concerned about, how do we raise him? What if we make mistakes? First child. Anybody in here that's raised a first child not ever wondered, well, am I doing it right? What if we make mistakes? So I think that they were probably very stressed out about it. Even with the assurance that God was watching over them and the angelic vision, you know, get out of here. You know, don't pass go, don't collect $200, you know, go on now. At the same time, I'm sure that they still saw, I mean, he's not a spirit that gets up and floats along out here in the air. You know, I will promise you, if we could go back and look, and he might heal up pretty quickly, but I guarantee you that Jesus stubbed his toe and he scraped his knee and, you know, those kinds of things. And cried when he did it. Otherwise, he's not really human. So how can he know?
It seems to me that Mary must have had some kind of deep understanding of the
Well, I think Mary knew he could do things, and she was trusting in that. But at the same, you know, and when she said in the Gospel of John, they run out of wine, and he said, so what? And she doesn't pay attention. She turns and says, okay, whatever he says, do, you do it, and then she walks off. Once again, that's one of those mom things. But I think she understood some things because she treasured these things. She pondered them. She reflected upon them. But at the same time, I think she worried when he was growing up, too. And she probably worried when he was a man and he starts getting in trouble and she hears all these rumors and she and his brothers go to get him away from this place because they think something's wrong with him. And then she has to stand at the foot of the cross and watch him die. So I think they were probably in her humanity. I don't see Mary. I don't see Joseph. Either one. Of course, Joseph I don't think was around all that much longer. I don't think he was there for Jesus' public ministry at all. But I think Mary was very human, and had to ask questions and had to wonder over time and in being reflective as well as otherwise. She may have understood some things, but there were other things she didn't. Bruce?
I'm sure you know, Dr. Hearn.
I'm not so sure.
The Catholics affirm that Mary was taken alive into heaven.
Yes. That's one of only the two or three papal infallibility statements.
And that was from 1951 with Pope Pius XII.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's also Roman Catholic tradition that there are two branches. One is that Mary never committed actual sin, but Jesus died for her so she could be pure enough to bear Jesus, but that Jesus died for her because of original sin. And the other view out there that was put forth centuries ago was that Mary actually she was kept from original sin by God so she could be worthy of bearing Jesus, but Jesus had to die for her because of actual sin she committed when she was growing up. So, but yeah, you know, there's a lot of that kind of thing.
Well,
let me ask you
something. Yes, Ed. The Catholics also consider the Reverend and that Jesus' brothers like you and I.
Jesus' brothers in traditional. Not all do, but in traditional Roman Catholic doctrine, Jesus' brothers and sisters were from a previous marriage that Joseph had and his wife died.
Exactly.
And so they were half-brothers and sisters.
Exactly.
Mary is... What's really interesting, and there are different takes on Mary and the reverence toward Mary, and while there are some who revere her almost godlike, the vast majority of practicing Roman Catholics do not. But I've had it explained a couple of different ways by priests, but not too long ago I heard a priest talking, and he said that it's kind of like, you know, we asked Mary to intervene with Jesus, and he said it's kind of like if you've got a brother and he's doing something that's not really exactly right, and you go to your mama and you say, "Mom, can you help me out here?" Or maybe he doesn't pay attention to you, or your father doesn't pay attention to you. "Mom, will you help me out here?" It's kind of like that. That, okay, Mary, will you help us out here in case Jesus doesn't listen? I think there's some, yeah. But that's one way that it's viewed. So Mary plays an important role, obviously, and especially after Joseph dies, Mary plays an important role as mother. And treasuring these things in her heart. We also find that the parents were religiously faithful. They were faithful to temple. They were faithful to synagogue. They were faithful to God. They were faithful to Deuteronomy saying, teach these things to your children. Talk about them with your children. We mentioned that, I believe, last week. Teach these things to your children. Talk about the law. Talk about what these things mean. At home and in the marketplace. As well as at the temple or synagogue. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I wonder how many of us still do talk with children or even grandchildren or nieces and nephews outside of church, talk with them about scripture and religious things and that kind of thing. They obviously thought it was important enough to teach and to lead Jesus even at home and to talk about these things like Deuteronomy says. Luke says they did everything according to the law, according to the law, according to the law. Now that doesn't mean that they were, okay, number one says, or if you ever watch it, Gibbs Rule 34, NCIS, yeah. These things that are written in stone. But it was, I'm sure it was being faithful to the law in a way of understanding that the law was there to lead, the law was there to guide, the law was there to protect. And the overarching whole idea of the law, even Decalogue when it was given and the covenant codes in the book of Exodus, they were to be general guides for living, and then specific situations to help, not to, to keep people boxed in, but help people grow and understand relationship with other folks. Now, I don't think that that really was so great when it came to saying, okay, well, this is how you're going to treat your concubines. But I think it was, you know, and therefore you should have concubines. I think it was, in all situations, all relationships, there should be, you should look out for the best interest of the other person. But here, they're religiously faithful to their religious ritual. They took him for circumcision. Luke 2:21. After 8 days had passed, it was time to circumcise a child, and he was called Jesus, the name given by the angel before he was conceived in the womb. Well, guess what? The law says any male that is born should be circumcised on the 8th day. That's the law. That's the religious ritual as well. Verses 22 and following. When the time came for their purification according to the law of Moses, they brought him up to the Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, as it is written in the law of the Lord, every firstborn male shall be designated as holy to the Lord. And they offered a sacrifice according to what is stated in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or 2 young pigeons. It's Mary's purification, but it's also the law, as we learned in Leviticus when we studied that bloody book on Wednesday mornings. Ask Jesselyn Watson when you see her how she likes the book of Leviticus. Too much blood and gore. But in the sacrifice, the firstborn animal was supposed to be offered to God in sacrifice. Well, you didn't, and the firstborn son was to be given to God in sacrifice. But rather than actually practice child sacrifice, the sacrifice of the animal was given not only for the purification of the mother, for the flow of blood in the birth process, but also as a ransom to buy back the life of the firstborn son, the baby. All that's according to the law. By the way, if you want to look up the law about the purification for birth, it's in Leviticus chapter 12. And they finished everything required according to the law. Verse 39 of chapter 2. After this sacrifice, when they had finished everything required by the law of the Lord, they returned to Galilee to their own town of Nazareth, and the child grew and became strong, filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. They're religiously faithful to leading Jesus also in the importance of religion and faith. And we see that, I think, inferred in chapter 2, verses 41 to 52. That is, Jesus in the temple at age 12. They raised Jesus according to the Jewish law. They talk about the Jewish law at home. Otherwise, he wouldn't have known all the things that he did, and he wouldn't have shown that interest. I mean, what 12-year-old kid hangs out in the church when the parents leave because they want to be in the church and they want to learn what's going on? Not too many of them. Right? And they took him to Jerusalem. The text says they took him to Jerusalem at the Passover every year. I mean, even when he was 2 years old, they took him to Jerusalem. What's he going to understand at 2 years old? But it's ingraining, it's teaching him, even at a very young age, that this is the place. So he recognizes things around him. We also can infer that Joseph taught Jesus the knowledge he had gained during his lifetime as a carpenter. And that's kind of part of what this picture is about here. This picture of Gerrit von Hontorst's Childhood of Christ, Oil on Canvas. As you've got Joseph, it's really interesting, you've got Joseph here woodworking. Jesus is looking really kind of almost lovingly at him with this sense of awe and respect for his father. Of course, it's kind of accident that the artist has Jesus' face illuminated by the candle that he's holding, because Jesus is what? That's right, the light of the world. Of course, in the background, you got 2 angels watching over it, and they're kind of conversing. Boy, isn't this something? The artist paints Jesus as somewhere around 8 or 9 years old in this painting, learning the skills in the carpenter shop. But Mark chapter 6 In Mark chapter 6, we read, let me get over there. On the Sabbath he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astonished, and they said, "Where did this man get all this? What is this wisdom that has been given to him? What deeds of power are being done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us?" Similar story, Matthew chapter 13. Actually, same story. Similarly told in 13:54 through 56. He came to his hometown and began to teach the people in their synagogue, so that they were astounded and said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these deeds of power? Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all his sisters with us? Where then did this man get all this?" Joseph taught Jesus the knowledge that he had gained during his life as a carpenter. Jesus, as the eldest son here, would have been expected to take over the family business. But also, Jesus' parables have such a touch point with ordinary everyday life that the inference is that Joseph, in times like this, when Jesus looked upon him with great respect and reverence and awe, Joseph taught him not only the knowledge of building these things and doing these things, but life lessons. I would not be surprised if we could go back in time that Joseph perhaps even talked with him about when he's building things at some point in time, about Noah building the ark, and about building of the Ark of the Covenant, and about the building of the temple, and all kinds of other things. And then we have Jesus in the temple at age 12. Now, family goes to Jerusalem every year. Though, as I said, though this does not mean that they only worship at Passover. They're not mere Passovers. I couldn't come up with anything like Creaster. They're not mere Passover, showing up just at Passover. But they go every year. They obviously have worshipped in synagogue in their hometown. This year, Jesus is 12. He stays behind, and his loving, frantic parents search until they find him. And some people say, "How in the world can you lose God's son? He's human." But not only that, he's on the verge of adulthood. I mean, he's really considered by many as an adult, and so he's given more freedom to come and go. And typically, at that particular point in time, age break, around 12 to 13, a boy could travel in the company of the women, because he's still not quite a man, if he so desired. He could travel with the women. You know, and some of those boys might have, let's see, by that time, oh, they might have had a first crush or two. But he could be traveling with the women and the girls, or since he is on the verge of adulthood, he could be traveling with the men. So, who knows? Mary might have thought he was with Joseph, and Joseph might have thought he was with Mary. Because, quite frankly, a lot of the times the women and the men, I mean, while they were traveling together, they were kind of split. The men went and they talked about their things, smoked their cigars and all that kind of stuff. No. But, you know, they went on in their little group, and the women were following along in another little group with children around them, boys and girls. Generally, the bar mitzvah and in conservative Jewish tradition now, as well as Reform, girls can have a bat mitzvah if they wish. They're coming of age. It was not the same ritual that we have now, but when you reach adulthood, and generally for a boy that was, in fact, a lot of times they were engaged by the time they were 12 years old. They're engaged 12, 13 years old. Well, and sometimes if families, depending on the status of families, you might even have them holding hands when they're in the stroller going down the street together. You know, from different families, they've already been pledged to each other. A lot of marriages were pledged marriages. And but so by that time, you know, they may have even been engaged or promised to somebody that was maybe 6, 7 years old. And the expectation was by the time that young woman reached puberty, she could be married. And so this whole thing, but once you became an adult male, women couldn't, but once you became an adult male at that age, 12, 13, breaking point, you had to have learned enough. You had to be able to read from Scripture, and you were allowed to read from Scripture. You were considered a man. You were allowed to make comments on Scripture. 12, 13 years old. And so, but Jesus gets here. They lose him, and when they find him sharing the ideas and the questions that were in his heart and mind. Asking questions. Answering questions. And I would imagine some of his questions might have even been encouraged by his parents. They're going there and he's asking a question and he asked Joseph. This would also have been the first time he could have carried the sacrifice in for the family. And maybe he asked Joseph a couple of questions about the law and Joseph wasn't exactly sure and he said, well, yeah, someday why don't you ask the rabbi? Well, Jesus decided this was the time. And so when they left, he stuck around, hanging out in the temple. And the teachers were amazed. They're amazed, first of all, that a 12-year-old wants to hang out with these guys instead of running around playing in other places. But secondly, they're amazed at the depth of his answers, the depth of his questions. Joseph and Mary faithfully brought him to every year, there every year, and instilled a love of God and a love for God and their religion. Now, how's that an example for us? Bringing children, caring for children, giving them opportunities, instilling in them at a young age a love for God. Not just a habit, although sometimes it has to start that way, but helping to explain and a love for God. You know, I mean, once we have children grades 3 and under go down, I think once they hit that, some of them, by the time they finish second grade and start third grade, they ought to be staying up with folks in the sanctuary and learning the things, the lessons, the songs, the rites, and then what they mean. But notice Heidi Hornick writes, despite his enjoyment of what he is doing and the fact that neither Mary nor Joseph seems to understand him, Jesus obediently follows them. From this point, Mary's role in the story takes a different tone. While continuing as the loving mother who will guide her son, she must also accept not only the sometimes painful separation as he matures, but the deep mystery of the earthly role given him by his father. Back to your earlier question, Ed. She's going to have to deal with that as time goes on. And those kinds of things. Simeon was an old priest who had been promised he would not die before he had seen the Messiah, the Lord's Christ.
When he told Mary that this child is his son, it seems to me that would wake her up to something.
Well, I think it probably did. The text says that she treasures these things, but at the same time, you know, over time.
Somebody told me as a mother that my child was born for a sign that I should wake up and die right.
Well,
well,
we might be, but we also have 20 plus centuries of hindsight, too.
Oh, okay.
The
virginal conception would give her a clue. Well, you would hope so, but and think so, but at the same time, growing up and going through all of these things, you still, you know, all kinds of questions.
She was immature herself, too.
Absolutely.
When all this was happening to her.
She is a young maiden. She's probably in her teens.
Yeah, and the stress.
Right.
Well, even if when he was 12 years old, she said, son, you have treated us like, why did you treat us?
Yeah, why did you treat us this way?
She was upset even.
And she was upset at that. I mean, he's 12 years old. He's a child. I mean, what parent, I will tell you, and I know I'm going to run long tonight. No, we're going to run long tonight, but I will tell you, I still remember when we lost Stephen.
No, he didn't lose him.
Well, he wandered away. We thought we had lost him. He wandered away. David was born in July, and that Christmas, we're in Sears Roebuck, at Holly Hill Mall in Burlington, North Carolina. David is in one of these little baby things here. Stephen is 4 years old. He's on the front of the buggy, and I'm pushing. We're going through the women's clothes. And Mary wanders off to the side, looking at women's clothes. No. Mary was looking at clothes, and this guy came wandering over and said, "Boy, y'all really had these are really nice looking children." I think his name must have been Bud Miller or something. Well, he smelled like Bud or Miller. You could smell him this far away. And so I said, "Okay, fine." Well, Mary, about that time, and he turns like he's going to leave, and Mary asks, she holds up, "What do you think of this?" And I look, I said, "I think that's really nice." And I turn back, and Stephen's gone. And immediately I said, "Stephen's gone. You stay here with David. I'm going to run, because the doors, double doors were right there. So I'm going to run and see if there's an old guy with him under his arm heading out through the parking lot." So I did, and he wasn't there. Not there. We looked, picked up the dress racks to make sure he wasn't hiding, that kind of thing. So then I said, "You and David, you keep looking. I'm going to go over." See, I was a good father. I tried to teach my child. And that was back when Atari was first around. And at Sears, you know, sometimes if you got bored shopping, you could go over and they'd let the kid, I'd let Stephen play the Atari and occupy. So I thought, well, maybe he wandered over there. I went over there. He's not there. And I come back. And I told Mary, I said, "Go back and look in the parking lot, see if there's an old guy with a kid under his arm." She did. No. So we were close to the doors leading out into the mall in general. And she is frantic, but not wanting to leave David alone. I said, "I'm going in the mall." And I found Stephen three stores up. I happened to look in the back of the toy store, and he's standing there looking at all the Star Wars stuff on the wall. Very relieved, but at the same time, we stopped in one of those little alleyways. I opened the door, and we stopped in one of those little alleyways, talk about real quick before we got back to Sears about how you don't wander off from Mommy and Daddy, especially during that busy time of the year. And I got to the seat of the problem very quickly. And he didn't do that again. But I can imagine how frantic they must have been, and the worry that you know. And I thought the sun rose and set in our children, but he didn't sit. He sat gingerly that evening. So you know, I can understand. You see these things and you wonder these things, but at the same time, we're only human, and sometimes we forget, and we really don't think about those things. So you know, here he's got all of this going on, and the text says that Jesus grew. He was obedient. He grew in human favor as well as that with God. And I think that Jesus' growth is possible, Krushwitz says, and I agree with him, Jesus' growth is possible because of the love and commitment of Mary and Joseph to him and to raising him. The other interesting thing that I noticed, thanks to a professor eons ago in seminary, if you want to look at it in 1 Samuel, especially in 1 Samuel chapter 2, there are parallels between Elkanah, the father, and Hannah, Samuel's parents, and Hannah's barren, and the sacrifices that they make and the love that they have for that child, and then they give that child up to God to be raised in the temple there at Shiloh, and what Mary and Joseph do in teaching Jesus and allowing him to grow. In the picture by Hanforth, Hornick writes, "Jesus intently watches his father with admiration and tenderness. Children are especially impressionistic at this age," and we're talking about 8-9 years old, "and parents are their most important role models." That's before they get way on up there and even get close to middle school. Parents are their most important role models. Verse 52 of chapter 2, when it talks about Jesus growing, in Luke, when it talks about Jesus growing in all areas, Jesus increased in wisdom and in years or stature and in divine and human favor, it talks about Jesus maturing. He didn't just stop there, he continued to mature. One writer suggests that Jesus is achieving an identity by the time he's 12, and his wisdom and obedience gained the attention of his human family and the teachers. But it also speaks to Jesus being instructed at home before he ever got to the temple. Hornick writes, "Children will relate to Jesus as a child who, like themselves, also wants to be listened to by adults." How often do we cut them off? How often do we cut children off? Children will relate to Jesus as a child who, like themselves, wants to be listened to by adults. So often children have much to say to busy adults who could learn much by taking time to sit down and listen. In fact, their honest and clear-thinking minds may reveal a profound insight. And does Jesus not talk about children regularly? God sent Jesus as a child to learn and grow within a family and a community, so that we too might learn how to grow within family and community, but also, I think, so that we as parents and grandparents and as surrogate parents for children can learn to help a child grow. We need to be open and allow God to fashion us to live in ways that please God and be positive role models and be positive teachers for children. Yes, statement was made last week, all this stuff needs to start at home, and that's true. But sometimes it doesn't get done at home. And so when we have opportunities, we should be ready. Even if it's just sitting down for a few minutes beside the child who has just stubbed their toe or who has just done something that irritated the hound out of you and you snapped at them and they went. But then to sit there and to try and, okay, I'm sorry, why did you do this? Or what's going on? Is there something bothering you? Or that kind of thing. So the question's then, how can we help children grow in wisdom and understanding? And there are all kinds of ways. And how do Mary and Joseph serve as those examples for us to guide children and balance listening with teaching? That may be the harder thing, to listen. I was going to say anybody remember, but you probably do, some of you. Anybody remember that when it came time to eat, especially when there were gatherings, the children were in another room, children were to be seen, not heard? And in those instances, they weren't even to be seen. It's amazing sometimes that we grew up like we did, isn't it? But I think that we see kind of some inferences here with Mary and Joseph of ways that we can perhaps be reminded of what it's like to be a child and how to nurture children. Especially how to nurture children. See, the sociological things, the cultural things that Jesus would learn as a child began in the religious understanding and religious teaching of Mary and Joseph and others around. And so I think that when we have opportunity, that's where we have to start. Simple to begin with and then move on as they mature. And we should always be, I'm becoming more and more convinced that we should be regularly evaluating the things that we have, materials we use to teach children, and even look for things that can perhaps guide them along in other ways and from which we learn. But I will tell you, early on, they may not figure it out, but if we don't put in the time to study and prepare and then look them in the eye, that child will find out pretty quickly how much we really care. And if we put in the time, we just might find them looking and paying attention this way, because they know we care. And yes, I've run over, and yes, it's 5.5 minutes too. But I want to allow for any other input that you might have.
Joseph is a saint in the Roman Catholic Church, of course.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
As John Paul II will be.
But I think Joseph is considered a saint primarily because of the way he cared for, in the brief time, Jesus.
They did.
Yes, Jesus would. No, he didn't. You're right, Susan. He was a good student, a good listener, but he didn't just regurgitate. And I'm not saying that we need to have children that all they do is regurgitate But if we start them out early enough and we're good role models, then there comes a point in time where, yes, we have to let them go and let them make their own decisions, but I think they'll be more likely to, even if we don't always like what they say or how they say it, at least they've had the opportunity to learn how to study and how to care and how to be cared for. Yeah, yeah. I think thinking is much greater than feeling, although you've got to have both. And I think Jesus thought. And therein, he got in even more trouble. It can't. But not thinking can also get you in trouble. Thank you all. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.